Hello, and welcome to Making the Museum. I'm Jonathan Alger, and this is a project of C&G Partners, Design for Culture. Today, I am joined by John Maas. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jonathan. Good to be here.
Awesome. To get started, for those who don't know you, could you tell our dear listener who you are and what you do?
Sure. So I'm an owner's representative and a project manager. And my company, Maas, is a company that works solely in the cultural world. We're only working with museums and performing arts centers and other not-for-profits, mission-driven institutions. And we do the typical owner's rep role. We hire design teams, we manage design processes, we hire builders, we manage the construction processes, but we also program buildings before any of that starts. So it's a very, you know, it's a full scope. They're very long projects that could be 3, 4, 5, 6 years long. And we've been doing this for the company. Our company's been doing this for about 5 or 6 years, but I've been doing it for closer to 25 years now.
Got it. And you're, in case people are already interested to call you up, I'm fascinated by the spelling of your last name, which is not the way it sounds. Your first name is spelled like mine, J-O-N. So, you know, hats off on that. Your last name, M-A-A-S-S.
Two A's like, and two S's, right.
Like a Scrabble star. That's awesome. Okay, in case people want to start Googling right away, which I'm sure they do. Okay, my favorite side question, you hinted at this, that you've had your own business for some time, but before that, you were already doing this. So how did you get into the business to begin with? What's the superhero origin story here? When it all began, how did you make it in? Because everyone comes in sideways. I always want to find out.
Yeah, that's really true. It was accidental. Like kind of every move that I've made, I went to school as an architect. I'm trained as an architect. I came to New York to go to Cooper Union. I got out of Cooper and I worked as an architect for a number of years. And then I very accidentally, it was back when we were doing more gig work, right? You'd work for a firm for a project and then you jump. And I was asking a builder, do you have any architects hiring? He said, no, I'm hiring. So I worked as in construction for about 5 or 6 years. And then I was at a job where they had an owner's rep. And I never worked with an owner's rep, but it was really, really clear at that meeting who was running that show. And I was like, I want to do that. And so through people at that firm, I got to meet them and it seemed to be the right move. And when I was interviewing there, I remembered the thing about being an architect, but also being a builder and understanding those perspectives, understanding what motivates those people, understanding what motivations they bring to the job and how those motivations might not be aligned. That's the job, like understanding the cultural aspect of these types of projects. And so I didn't really quite get it immediately, but I was fairly well suited for that work, having worked on both sides of the drawings.
Wow. Okay. So we have a lot in common, same first name, and also training in architecture and working also building things, which I did also. Yeah, I agree. It's a well-rounded thing. It used to be that if you were going to be a well-educated person, you had to take the world tour and learn everything. And maybe in this business, it would be helpful to take a little bit of the tour that you're talking about. That's great. Okay, so today you've got something really interesting to talk about. It's a little bit kind of a surprising thing to talk about, which I think is great. So let's get right into this for our dear listener. Here we go. Today's episode is Museum Projects Are Chaotic, and That's a Good Thing, with John Maas. So as always, I have the list and my guest has the rest. Today we have 6 points, if listeners want to keep track, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And number one sort of introduces this idea of museum projects are chaotic. You talk about what chaos is to start with. So put your point number one is chaos theory. Chaos theory studies things that are impossible to predict. I've heard about chaos theory. I don't know a lot about chaos theory. I'm sure our listeners are the same. You know, when I think of chaos theory, I think of clouds, I think of weather, I think of politics 10 years from now, as opposed to the linear process we think we should have and which we try to create, but we can't. Am I on the right track there?
Yeah, I think so. You know, this all started with we do a lot of thinking in our office of like we're constantly staring at projects, and when we see complications, like why is that? And then you look at all the projects and you realize there's a lot of complication in all of these projects. And it was actually my wife who said, like, it's like chaos theory, like what you're, and we started to Google like every definition of chaos theory as we were putting this little talk together at the Building and Museums Conference. There's this one line, it was really great. It was, chaos is the science of surprises and the nonlinear and the unpredictable. And I was like, that's it. That's totally it. And so we started to look at, and we had apprehensions. I had a few people join me for this talk. Jessica Ludwig from the Morgan Library, Abe Smith from Allied Works, and Joe Mizzi from Siami. Three like kind of hard to find people from an owner, an architect, and a builder side who are more qualified to talk about the complications in these types of projects. And we started to talk about it. We're like, do we really want to lead with chaos? Like as a word. And I said, no, we should embrace that word, but on a level of chaos theory, which is there's a lot of unpredictability, but if you look at it carefully, if you embrace it, if you can leverage it and manage it to your benefit. That was the driving force behind this whole talk. And it seemed to sort of capture well the dynamic of these projects. So that's kind of how we led into the whole theory that goes along with this in terms of these types of projects.
And were the people that were on your panel, were those all people that you had worked with before or did a project all together as a team before? Or are they just all coming from different professional walks of life?
Jessica, I had a long history actually with Joe and with Jessica and not with Gabe. That's not true. I mean, I worked with Gabe when he was at a previous position prior to Allied Works. I worked with him on the Museum of Modern Art in Warsaw. I was working for another firm. I was writing that program. So I was working closely with Gabe and the museum on that project. Jessica and Joe, we worked going all the way back to the exterior restoration of the Guggenheim, and then much more recently working at the Morgan Library, where we oversaw the restoration of the McKim building and the whole landscape that was built there. So yes, as all three of us know, but Joe and Jessica and I have had a pretty long history working together.
I kind of like that. You use the word oversee or oversaw a couple of times, that you are overseeing things. I like that idea that there needs to be someone in these complex projects who is seeing over, like everything is below, and you're at an altitude, or you're up high enough to see everything. And at least if it is chaos theory, at least you can maybe see where the particles are going because you are seeing over.
It's funny, one of your previous guests, Andy Klemmer, once said, the perfect meeting for an owner's rep, the perfect meeting is the meeting where you don't have to say anything. Because it's like, if the team is all operating really, really, really well, they're posing and solving their own problems at the same time. It's rare that I'm in a meeting I don't speak up. But oversight seems to be a fairly decent word for the work that we do.
Okay, so point number two, museum projects, and this is our sort of title point. And I think we're going to have to get into this a little bit because I think when you first told me this, when I first heard about this, when our listeners are going to hear about this, they're all going to say, like I said, what? Yeah. So here we go. Point number two, museum projects are chaotic, and that's a good thing. So maybe we break that down. How are they chaotic? Let's just talk about that for a second.
Yeah.
And then how is that good?
Okay. So let's get into this. So they're like, we could start. And I did a little diagram during this little seminar that ended up being more popular than I thought it would be. But I did this little diagram and I started with the typical project triangle. Right? You have the owner, you have the architect, you have the builder, and three-legged stool, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone talks about this. I said, well, let's just look at this. I said, when it comes to the owner, it speaks to maybe one of the other points about like museum owners aren't really made to do a design and construction project. No one goes to school and works in a museum because they want to get into the design and construction world. But so in an ideal project, an ideal owner is one person kind of speaking very, very clearly on their own behalf. You can imagine a residential owner, very clear, right? One person or maybe a couple, and they are speaking about what they want in a house. But at a museum, you have a director, and then that director might be very closely assisted by a deputy director or a CFO. And then they have a whole staff, right? Conservation, curatorial, education, visitor services, facilities, like heads of all these various departments. And those staff members, they have staff. So it's a very, very big group of people, and they are conditioned. The culture of a museum is to listen to all of those people. It's not corporate. It's not top down. It's like, you know, usually a director's going to say, I don't know what the education folks need. They use those spaces day in and day out. Let's ask them. And so in terms of like compiling a program for a project, it's multifaceted. It's many, many programs inside of one big program. And then on top of that, if that weren't enough, then you have a whole board. And guess what? Like, you know, they're not wallflowers. They have their opinions, and some of them may be more vocal than others. And then on top of that, you have donors. And many donors might say, well, I'm happy to make this donation, but I'd like to be a participant in this process. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's exactly how museums should operate. But it makes for a very, very complex owner. And they're going to write a program. So it's like someone like me or others are going to like try very, very hard to like take everything that they want in a building. We're going to put it into a program. And then we're going to pass. So that's part of the chaos, right? It's like wrangling a multi-headed owner that is rightfully so. And then you pass that program down to a design team. And someone like Gabe is going to step in, and they're going to try to satisfy like an impossible task to some extent. It's very common that what one person wants in that out of that building, what one staff member wants, is going to be in conflict with what another person, and they have to do it on a budget, and we have a certain number of square feet that we can build and a certain number of dollars that we can spend. And so Gabe is, it's challenging. It's remarkably challenging in what he has to do. But he's going to do it, and he's going to do it with a design team that's not 5, 6, or 7 consultants, it might be 25, 26, or 27 consultants, right? Because these are very, very high performance buildings. So if you're going to have a conservation lab, you're going to have a conservation lab consultant. If you're going to have art storage, you're going to have an art storage consultant. If you're going to have special facade systems, you're going to have a special facade system consultant. It's like these teams can become very, very large. So he's going to manage all of those people. And he's going to create a set of documents, and he's going to pass that set of documents on to a builder. And the builder is going to represent this like cultural shift in a way. They're going to come in, and they're likely to work with a GMP, guaranteed maximum price. They're going to have a guaranteed price. They're going to have a guaranteed schedule. And in order to guarantee that, it's going to come with it a remarkable amount of rigor. Right, these builders, the ones who are really good at it, they are remarkably buttoned up. They come up with a very clear plan, and all they want to do is execute that plan so that they can do it efficiently, they can make some money along the way, and at the same time, they can make sure they're guaranteeing that cost and that schedule. But the chances of change happening during that process is not likely, it's guaranteed. With this type of owner and this type of designer, the chances of changes, and some of them being substantial, during the construction processes, it's a certainty. And so those best laid plans by the builder are almost always going to be upended. And so when we look at this, that all sounds chaotic. What's good part about it is that the builder, or the owner, that interrogation that's happening inside the owner, that's creating a better program. It's creating a more informed program. It's causing people to say, that's a good idea, but let's push on it more. Let's push on it more. Let's push on it more. And so actually that program, if it's done well, you're getting your owner's head around it. They're getting organized, and they're creating something that is bespoke to their institution, so they don't come up with just any old museum building. They pass it on to a design team, and like the best ones are remarkably creative. They're remarkably flexible, right? They're remarkably smart. And so these projects, if you're choosing your team right, you're getting the best of the best. They're attracted to this, but they would say themselves, I don't make a lot of money, but I'm doing this because it's good. It's good for the community. we're creating great architecture, and we have an owner who believes in creating great architecture. And then when it comes to the builder side, it's hard. But the truth of the matter is that all the changes that are being proposed, they're actually all about making the building better. No one's making the change because they want to make the builder sad. No one's doing it for that. No one's doing that in order to, well, let's make this change so we make the building worse. Like, that's not the case. They're always trying to make it a little bit better. And so my whole thesis on this was that all of that, the bad and the good, all of it comes together. And my argument is that that's what makes these projects so celebrated. You know, that's what makes them so great. That's what makes everyone want to go see them, because they're hard, they're challenging. And those challenges inherent in that process, I think, bring out the best of people. And they result in a group of human beings making something that's remarkably good.
I want to follow up a few things on that. First of all, you mentioned the diagram, and this is an audio medium, so I want to kind of flesh out that diagram. You had two of them. You started out with talking about the diagram as drawn originally, which is the contractor's triangle, the owner. Imagine a triangle. One vertex is labeled owner. Another vertex, are those vertices? They're vertices, yeah, is labeled a builder. The other one is labeled architect. So it's the person who's going to own the building, person who's designing the building, person who's going to build the building. But then your description about the complexity of the owner's subparts and the builders and all the sub-consultant, the 25, 26, the facade consultant for that triangle rapidly becomes sort of like a spider web by a spider that is both drunk and on amphetamines, right? It's right. Just, or in short, you know, chaos. Like, think chaos, yeah, theory. They often apply it to, you know, flocks and spider webs and things like that just can't be predicted where they're going. So I just want to give the listening audience a sort of a visual on that. Starts out as this simple little triangle, and then sort of imagine someone sketching frantically to make it a diagram that becomes very difficult to follow. And also a jargon watch thing, you use the word program. That's a word that I like to define for my audience, because it means so many different things to everyone in this industry.
Right, totally.
In this case, we're not talking program like program a computer, or program like a series of evening events for which I receive a program. This is the architectural sense of program, which means a list or some document that describes the rooms needed, the facilities needed, their sizes, their adjacencies, and their features. It's the thing that an architect has to have in order to start designing anything that will be at all in keeping with what you need. So that's what program means.
Right.
And one last thing I want to mention. If, dear listener, if it hasn't occurred to you, I'm sure it has, everything that John is saying applies to other things as well, like the creation of an exhibition, which might be done at the same time as a museum building, where you have an owner, you have a designer, you have a builder, same thing. It applies to many things in life. This chaos theory thing is sort of, I'm like, my mind is a little blown here. It applies to many things in life. But I did want to ask, does your work in performing arts centers also apply equally? Is it equally complex? Is it equally potentially chaotic in a good way? Is that true for all projects? Is that true for cultural projects? There must be some projects that aren't as chaotic.
It's very similar. They're high performance buildings that have to accommodate either very specific activities or just the opposite. They have to be so flexible that they can accommodate many, many, many different activities. And a performing arts center is also characterized by these many different specialties all under one roof, all led by typically one person. And you have the programming side of it, to your point about definition, the people who are actually choosing the type of artworks that would be staged there. You have the people, the technical side of it. You have visitor services people who have to handle large crowds of people. You have marketing, you have development, you have office spaces that are going to be needed.
Donors coming to the meetings like you described before.
Exactly right. We could have another discussion about like the stark differences between the two, but if we're talking generally about a project, we find those to be complex. We've done landscapes and they're also complex. They sort of have a certain level of complexity, but cultural institutions in general are defined because they do so many things, and because they're trying actually to do, I think, more and more and more things. I mean, there's a whole movement about the museum as the community center, right? And so they're trying to do, I think, even more things for their audience. I just think it becomes more and more complex.
Right, so those single dots on that triangle, all of them break into huge org charts. And part of the complexity of culture is that the owner dot breaks into a very big org chart where it's not necessarily 100% central controlled.
Right.
In some situations, like the head of something says, my way or the highway, I'll consult with my folks, but you listen to me only. But that's not true with our cultural organizations. It's very consensus driven. And that's why you have this sort of additional level of complexity. But if you mentioned residential work. So if you're working with a person who needs to build a hut, and there's one person who's going to build the hut, and you made a sketch, that's much less complicated because that's three people.
Right. We worked on a project years and years ago, and we came on board and there was a program, and we started to like poke at it in terms of what any constituency might need. And we realized very quickly that everything came from the director. Everything came from the director. And so to some extent, okay, fine, that's well and good. If that's the way the institution is run, maybe that director is remarkably connected with everybody there. But then something happened that happens a lot, actually. The director changed. And people would be surprised to hear that in almost every one of my projects, maybe 80% of the projects I've worked on, a director has changed throughout the process. And that is talk about chaos. And so a new director came in, and she said, what do the people say? And I said, well, we haven't spoken to like your staff. What do you mean? You haven't spoken? You need to talk to our staff. And we were in the middle of design. We were in design development at that point. And people were saying, well, it's the first time anyone's ever asked us any questions about it. Talk about chaotic. I mean, we had to and the director had different vision for the building, different vision than her predecessor. So we were sort of changing lots and lots of things. But it's the nature. No one's going to blame an institution for changing a director. It happens, but it happens more than you think. And so it's hard to wrangle sometimes. We'd like to think we do it well. I mean, it's our job. At the end of the day, it's our job.
So speaking of directors and people on teams, your point number three is related to that. Point number three is a project is a cultural exercise with a diverse culture. The project itself has a diverse culture of people in it. Can you unpack that? I'm thinking you mean diverse in the broadest sense, just all kinds of different perspectives, people coming from all different walks of life, et cetera, or do I have that right? Is that the right idea?
It's a cultural exercise, and then there's cultural diversity, and I mean two different things sort of by the two different uses of that word. Broadly, it's a cultural exercise, meaning, and I say this to my students all the time, it's like, it's a bunch of human beings coming together to do something that's way above average. It's super hard, but it speaks to, I guess, to our role, which is like, we're overseeing, like we're trying to manage this big, big group of people to keep them all, and they all come they all come with different motivations. And it's challenging, but it's okay, right? The builder is there for a different reason. The architect is there for their own reason. The owner is there for their own reason. We all can come together and say, we can satisfy all satisfy what we're looking for by building a great building. But, you know, they're all looking for slightly different things. So that's like the first culture. When I say cultural diversity, I'm generally referring to the introduction of like each of these parties. And specifically, I think about the builder, right? So you have a group of people, you have this management structure on the construction manager level, then you have all of these subcontractors. And, you know, some of those subcontractors may visit the museum and love it. And some of them might not even know it even exists. But they're all marching to a certain, they're marching to a certain drumbeat that is importantly set by the owner, right? So the owner, they want a guaranteed maximum price. You know, typically a cultural owner that is risk adverse is going to say, I'm willing to pay a little bit more for the certainty that comes along with the GMP. Okay, that's great. No problem. And it also comes with a certain level of a guarantee about the schedule. And then you're going to pass that on to a builder, right? A construction manager. Construction manager is going to say, okay, we're going to take that on. We're going to accept that. And they're also going to be passing that risk on to subcontractors. That happens just as part of the process. But the rigor associated with that construction process is sometimes it takes museums and architects, depending on the architect, by surprise, right? So there's this culture there. The builders are used to working in that arena day in and day out. And an owner might say, someone on the owner's side might say, well, I don't understand why I can't change that because they're only building a foundation right now. Well, the builders realize that everything that's being built on top of that foundation, they're dealing with that months and months and months ahead of time. So there are these, it's like, that's what I mean by cultural diversity of bringing all of these various people together on a project and understanding and just embracing it, leveraging it and embracing that they're all there for a different reason. And you have to understand where they're coming from, understand what they're bringing to the project, understand what they're trying to take away from the project. And I, you know, try to speak that language for that entire group.
So that diagram we were talking about that starts out as the triangle, but then becomes sort of crazy and complex, like a diagram of a neurons in a brain or something. And in what you do for these kinds of chaos projects, you have to try to keep that diagram in your head, right? Built into your head so that when you get a call, I don't know, the director of a museum says to you, hey, John, hey, couldn't we just move that foundation wall over a little bit? There's a guy on the site here who says I can't do it, but can't we do it? Now you have to, that diagram needs to kind of appear in your own like heads up diagram in your eyes and say like, okay, director, other person, their motivations, director used to work at this museum, assumes this, just came in, doesn't, you have to kind of calculate all of that stuff to be able to be useful. What are all the relationships? What does everyone else know?
Right. And to say to the owner in that case, yes, yeah, you can do anything you want. You're the owner. But don't think that it's going to come at without a cost and a schedule impact. It's just, you know, you've signed up for a GMP, but a guaranteed maximum price doesn't mean guaranteed no matter what comes along. It's guaranteed for a certain design documented in a set of drawings. That's where the guarantee is tied to. As soon as the rules change, the design aspiration changes, something else changes.
A guaranteed maximum price to deliver this thing here.
Right. And that's our role.
Anything you think of. Right. Yeah.
And that's our role to protect the builder in that case or protect the architect in that case. I mean, we say all the time that, I know a lot of owners reps say we're owner's advocates. And I say, no, we're project advocates because what you've actually asked us to do is to create a great project. That's what you've asked us to do. And we need to be like, you know, we're driven by advocacy for that type of thing. But it does require like this balance, you know, amongst all the parties.
That's a really interesting point that you just made. I think it's more than a nuance. The idea that if you're overseeing everything, that you need to be the advocate, not for the owner, which might be a little perverse because the owner, I think, a lot of times has hired you. They're the ones
we're representing them. We're paid for them.
Right.
We're
owner's
making
rep,
sure
OR
that they are being
representative.
Yeah. They're being, I mean, we are there to, I mean, we certainly do advocate for them. We make sure that they are treated fairly by all of these various parties, but it doesn't mean that the builder and the architect are by default always wrong.
Just well, because also,
if they're countering
like
the owner.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I just reacted to was the fact you said, you just introduced the term project advocate, or almost instead of owner's rep, project rep, that it's the owner's project, they wish to do it. The builder wasn't walking down the street one day and said like, you know, I'd kind of like to build a building. Let me find an owner. That's not how it works. The owner's like, I need to do this thing. I need more space for the thing. I need to deal with the other thing. I got a grant that the donor wants. Okay, so the owner wants to have this building. But the building is a project, and the project has certain goals. It needs to appear at a certain time. It needs to be done for a certain budget. It needs to be done to a certain level of quality. It has to have certain innovative features or whatever it may have. So there are certain goals. And because you just said, maybe I'm just nerding out here, but you just said project advocate. It sounds like that's really what you're doing if you take a position in the middle of that triangle as opposed to being the spokesperson of one dot on the triangle, because sometimes an owner can actually get in the way of their own goals on a project. They might, the goals of the project are stated, and that's your mission. You have to do it the way the owner tells you, but your mission is actually the goal of the project. Am I over my skis here? I feel like I'm over my skis.
It's our job to pursue the mission of the project until the mission of the project is changed by the owner. The owner always has the right to do that, always. But it might be our job to say, we're on site, we're seeing how this thing is coming together, this space, this element, what have you. And it might be wrong. Sometimes we have architects who pick up on this, sometimes it's the builder, sometimes the owner themselves. But we might be saying, again, we'll do what you want us to do. But the truth of the matter is that if you want to achieve your goals as documented in the program that we helped you write and that we were there along the whole time, and importantly, that it was a very collaborative process. By the time we got to the end of this program writing, we hopefully had our act together as an owner, right? It was interrogated by many, many people. In order to achieve that, you might need to make a change. And it might be, it'd be our job just to point that out. And they could say, yes, we should spend a little bit of money and make that change. Or no, we don't want the time impact. We don't want the cost impact. Just stay the course. And fine, we would absolutely do that. So, but yeah, sometimes the project, you need, it's like, it's almost like this fourth entity, you have the owner, you have the builder, you have the contract, you have the project, which is this living, breathing thing that is driving everybody, and it can't be ignored.
Right. I like that you used in the mission, in the military, it's all about the mission, achieve right. The mission. I think that's, we're not in the military, but there are some similarities there, I think. But let me do a quick station identification. If you are just joining, you're listening to Making the Museum. I'm Jonathan Alger, and this is a project of C&G Partners Design for Culture. If you find this show valuable, please help spread the word. You can rate the show in Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can write a review in Apple Podcasts. And thank you for everyone who has made this show a 5-star podcast. 1-star review people, just go over to that other podcast. I don't know what the other podcast is, but go over there. You can also just tell a friend to check out makingthemuseum.com for everything about this podcast and its sister newsletter. Now let's get back to the show. Today, I'm talking with John Moss about museum projects are chaotic, and that's a good thing. We have 6 points today. We've done 3. So next up is number 4. And this is a tongue twister, and it's a hard to forget one. You alluded to this before in one of our earlier points, and that is point number 4. Museum owners are not built to build buildings. Sally is at the seashore and she's got seashells. Museum owners are not built to build buildings. And you talked about that, and of course they're not. They didn't go to school for that. They probably never did it before. They probably need someone like John Moss to show up and help them figure out how to do that. What can we do about that? Because that would seem to be, well, given the title of our show today, that would seem to be adding to the chaos.
First of all, it acknowledges a reality. It's not meant to be critical. But, like I said earlier, I don't think anyone who works for a museum, a museum professional, maybe someone in the facilities department, but for the most part, these folks they're not motivated by designing a building. That said, museums, I think, acknowledge that their missions are tightly tied to the structure that houses what they do. Certainly when it comes to the collection and protection of physical culture, of artworks, you got to keep the rain out, right? It's like, you need that. So they're necessary. I don't want to think that everyone thinks of them as necessary evils. I think I find people in the museum world who would say that, like, I wish I didn't have to spend all this money on this building. I'd rather spend the money on curatorial endeavors or what have you, but it is what it is. And so, we had this during the discussion at building museums, Jessica made some really, really great points about this. Like, we were talking about how, like, the challenges, like, how do you manage that? How does someone like Jessica, as a deputy director, manage a staff to take on something that is over and above what they have to do every single day, right? So, you know, they have their own jobs, and then we're bringing in this other thing that's going to, it's going to demand a lot of their time, a lot of their attention, a lot of their energy. And if we start with just the, like, the basic assumption that the project is in service to the mission, then the question, then the next thing is, like, how do you rally everybody in the museum around this effort? How do you get them excited about doing this? How do you wrangle it? Can it be a collaborative effort? Can it be a team building effort? So you have to get, and the other thing that's really interesting is that you have people like me and people like architects who are sitting down with all of them, and we're saying, what do you do? And how do you do it? And you're forcing them to put that into words. Again, so, like, they know how to do what they do, but it might be a little bit uncomfortable when you have these people sitting on the other side of the table interrogating them about, you know, what do you want people to feel like when they walk into this room? What does the process of getting to this room feel like? What's that supposed to be? What is the room supposed to do for you? How is it supposed to enable what you do on a day-by-day basis? There's so many things there that is, I think, a little bit outside of what they would do on any day, on a day-to-day basis. Some of them are remarkably enthusiastic about it, and some of them are just less so. But they all are contributing to it, and they're all contributing to it because I think they all acknowledge that without the building, they can't really, you know, they can't do what they do.
So if museum owners are not built to build buildings, then in all of this good chaos, are you an overseer, or are you a therapist, or are you a cheerleader? Because I just, the way you described, you know, you're sitting down, this whole group of museum people come in, the staff there, maybe it's a situation you described where 80% of, in your practice, the director changes in the middle of your, so there's a lot of what they euphemistically call change management, right?
Yeah, right.
That's a euphemism if I've ever heard one. But you're often trying to help manage that. So people come in and you're like, well, these are the, as you pointed out, the chaos comes from the people. So you have to manage the people. You have to know the people. What's your role? Are you a therapist? Are you a cheerleader? How do you help the director get these people to do these things?
I think you have to be a little bit of everything, and you have to be a business manager because you have to do it according to a budget. You have to manage what they're telling you, what the size of that building is going to be, or what everything that needs to go into that building, how that building needs to be designed to perform well, all of that. And so we find ourselves in the middle of it. I think rightfully so. We're constantly reminding ourselves that we are the owner's representative, meaning we are tied to the owner. If I'm not on a first name basis with pretty much everybody in that museum by the end of the project, I did something terribly wrong. Like we become like very, very embedded with usually the full breadth of the staff. And it's because they are counting on us to be experts on creating this building. You know, people, I always have a very hard time explaining to people like what I do. And I say, you know, a museum comes along and they say, we have a need and we have a source of money. We realize, and maybe we don't really know what to do next. We know we need a building and we know that we have a way that we can pay for it. What do I do? And we step in, right? And we're trying to basically say, well, the first thing you're going to do is document what you need. And we know how to do that. And then the next thing you're going to do, and that's not just me, there's a lot of ownerships who do this. We think we do it well, but there's, you know, many who do this. And then we're gonna find you the right architect. And we feel very, very strongly in architectural processes, selection processes, as opposed to competitions. Like, write that program first, get your thoughts clear, take that and then use it to choose an architect. And then once we get that architect, then we have the team build the team. Architects will choose structural engineer and architect will choose the engineers, et cetera. Like, the team will just help choose their own team. And we'll get to the team in a second. And then we have to find a builder. And then we have to oversee that whole process. So they're very, very long processes. But when it comes to the owner, we're usually, you know, if we like it if we are maybe the first person that's called from the museum when something is, when they're having a hard time maybe resolving something or what have you. as their representative, we're trying to make sure that we are at the center of it and representing them well when it comes to building something that's, you know, bespoke.
Do you think, going back to what you said about your early career and that being on a first name basis with everybody, I'm kind of imagining what you do is kind of the consigliere of the of the museum, for the museum director or something like that. I wonder, do you think that to do what you do well, to be a, because listeners are probably thinking, oh, I was inspired by hearing an owner's rep at some point, now I'm hearing him, now I want to do that. Do you think it's helpful to be a good practitioner of what you practice to get a very broad experience in the business? It seems like if you're a specialist in only one area, that leads you to becoming a greater specialist. But for what you do, you actually need to be a little bit of a generalist. Does that ring a bell?
The ultimate generalist, in a way.
Ah,
yes.
Okay.
I think that we do well because we understand where people are coming from. We have on our staff, we have like professional builders, people that have spent almost 20 years in the construction management world, construction managers, right? So you could say, well, we should just fill our office with museum professionals. We should all be museum professionals in this office. We're not, because we have to do so many different things. So we have architects who work for us. We have construction professionals who work for us. We have conservators who work for us. And the good news is that all of them have some sort of museum history. It could be building museums. It could be working in museums, what have you. If we're in a conversation with a conservator and we're giving them blank looks when they're saying that I need this, 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 and this out of their space, I'm not resonating with them and I'm not helping them. I'm not helping them interrogate what they need. And also at the same time, bringing experience from past projects to say, you know, we've done seven different conservation labs. We learned a lot and we can bring that to bear on any given project going forward. So it seems to me that that really helps us. And I think going back to that first job that I had was, but you know how the architect thinks, you know how what their process looks like. And the same thing from the builder side. You understand how that business works. You understand the dynamic between a construction manager and subcontractors. You understand that some guys are there because they want to build something great and some guys are there to collect their check on Friday. Like, you get that. And it's important. I think it's important. I think we do a better job if we're able to bring all of that broad general knowledge to bear.
Excellent. You know, you were mentioning a couple times building museums. Just for our listeners, John is referring to the Building Museums Symposium, which is a once a year event of the Mid-Atlantic Association of Museums. Happened not so long ago. We're recording this in April of 2024. Happens every around the first quarter of every year. Great thing to go to. Look for that next year and years after that if you want to be in this business. All right. So point number five, you foreshadowed this one just a moment ago. Design teams who excel at museum projects are rare. Is that because most design teams haven't done them before? Or because a lot of them have tried and they're no good? What do you mean by rare?
I've come to realize that the success and failure of a project, it really hinges completely on three things, right? One is you need to capture it well in your program. That's like kind of the number one thing. If you can't cap, it becomes the North Star. Your program and your budget and your schedule. It's like all of those things come together. And if they're not synthesized well and they don't represent the owner well, you will not come up with a great building that is purely tailored to you as an institution. That's number one. Number two has to do with the other, like number two and three go to this team thing. Your project hinges on the architect and the design team that you choose, no doubt. And we've worked with architects who have built many, many museums, and we've worked with architects who have built no museums. And there's just a very, very stark difference. There's a stark difference. And so, like, choose wisely. But I would say your point here is about the design teams who excel. But I would say the same thing. I should say, you know, it's design teams and it's the builder. I think that the reason I reached out to Joe Mizzi is that, you know, Siami has done, you know, at that seminar, I read through a short list of the projects that the museum projects they've done. It's astounding. And I think they gleaned over that is that, like, these are complex and there's a way of managing that complexity. And it goes down to, like, choosing the right subcontractor, because some subcontractors, like some construction managers, are going to say, give me the drawings, give me on the site. I just want to get in and get it out and I want to be done. Some are going to say, when they're faced with this idea, like, hey, I want you to sit down with the architect. I want you to understand. I want you to contribute, builder. I want you to contribute to making this better, making it less costly, making it more efficient, making it higher quality. And some will say, great, wonderful. Yep, we do that. And then you press them and there's nothing there. And others will robustly accept that challenge. They love doing it. Those are the people we want. And it's the right. Same thing. So it's on the builder side, but it's the same thing on the design side. It's like some architects are made for this. And I would say that there is so much to know when it comes not just to the architect, but to many aspects of the design team. There's a ton that they bring to the process that, like, doesn't even get captured in writing. They just know it. They know what a museum is going to take. And, you know, I think a lot of people look at museums and say, I don't get it. It's like, they're white boxes. How can it be so hard?
Having done museum projects in the past not only tells you that that design team or that building team have relevant experience. So if you've done 10,000 knee surgeries, the next one probably won't rattle you too much. And that's good. But it also means that they know what they're getting into. Like if you've said yes to come back repeatedly to do museum projects, you must know what is about to happen. And therefore, you've kind of drunk the Kool-Aid, so we pick you. And if you're someone who hasn't done a lot of those projects, neither of those things are true. And in that direction lie monsters.
Right. Exactly right. It comes down to mechanical systems. It comes down to waterproofing systems. It comes down to the size and proportions of galleries. It comes down to progression through galleries, how you move from one to another. All of these things, like, usually, you know, when I'm writing a program, I'm trying very, very hard to make sure that the owner is not designing in the program. Like, we would not say, make sure you arrange this gallery next to, like, you should move from this gallery to this gallery in exactly this way. We're usually saying, how do you want people to experience it? And we're letting the architect be the agent of designing something that satisfies that experience. But if you have not designed museum buildings before, you're going to be challenged in doing that. And so
I think it's just the idea that you're bringing up, that there's so many metaphors about this, I can't even pick one. The idea that something that to one person would be an unpleasant duty, to another person is an attractive perk.
Right.
Like, oh, you're going to have to, you're a MEP consultant. In order to do your work, which you'd like to just go home, see your family. Yeah. Nothing against any of that. In many ways, we all want that too. But you, MEP consultant, you're going to have to bone up on the impressionists. Now, for some MEP consultants, they're going to be like, wow, sounds great. Let me add it. And for others, they're going to be like, which way is the exit? Is that to the left? Was that to the
right? I was just on the phone the other day with a great engineer from Altieri. So Altieri is like a really, really great MEP engineering firm. They've done a lot of museums. And I was talking about, like, I was sort of saying it in a very quick way, like, in terms of, we need to maintain climate in this art storage space. And it slipped out, like 50-70, right? We all talk about 50-70, like generally 50-70, right? 70 degrees and 50% humidity. And he immediately said, well, of course it's different. The temperature is going to be lower in art storage. There was no research there. He didn't have to, like, Phil didn't have to, like, think about that. Like, he just knows it. He knows it because he's done it many, many, many times. And there are, you know, it's like there's just a vast amount of knowledge that people glean from doing this over and over and over again. So, you know, it's like it's hard to replace it. It's hard to replace it. And so it's critical. And if someone does have to bone up on it, I'd rather you not be boning up on museums. I'd rather you bring that knowledge with you, and I'd rather you be spending your time, you know, designing and iterating and whatever.
For sure. We'll do our last point, but before we do that, I just want to reiterate to our listeners, everything that John's talking about really applies to many other kinds of projects too, especially in our sector. I'm biased, but exhibition and experience projects have that same contractor triangle that's not a triangle, but is in fact a crazy spider web. And many other projects too, a web design project. I mean, basically anytime you have a recipe where there's an owner, which is a complex multi-part owner, you have a builder, which is a complex multi-part builder, you have a design and planning group that's a complex multi-part group, that's where you get this kind of, as John is putting it out there, it's kind of good chaos. So let's close it out with your sixth point. As always, I've got the list, but my guest has the rest. So you know what's behind this. It seems to me to be very uplifting, and it's kind of, we're actually recording this on a Friday. It's a Friday afternoon. I'm like, this is a great note for my Friday afternoon. In fact, we just let the record show that it is actually Friday, April 5th. There was just an earthquake on the East Coast. So this is a great, this morning, everything's fine. But yeah. Point number six, change during the process is inevitable, so embrace it. Change is inevitable, so embrace it. That sounds like you've been to the wars and you have some philosophy to share. What have you learned? Why do you feel this way?
When during the seminar, Joe Missy shared this. It was kind of a general story, but I'm sure he ran into it many times, because it was one of the first things that came to his mind, I think, in terms of answering my question. But he was saying, you know, a lot of times a change will come up and an owner's rep's initial thought is, ignore it. We're not going to have that change. We're not going to have that change. And then the change thought doesn't go away. They keep hearing it from either our staff, but someone keeps saying, we need to make this change. Well, we're fighting back against this. And then the third time, are you sure we're going to make this change? And the owner's rep finally comes around and says, yeah. I tried really hard. We can't make this change. And he's like, just make the change. Just make the change already. Because we've spent so much time saying that we're not going to make this change. We're going to fight against this change. Maybe that goes back a little bit to like project advocacy versus owner advocacy. I mean, I don't know. But it's probably the owner's rep saying, Are you sure? Let's keep trying to avoid the change, because we know that part of project advocacy is maintaining a budget and maintaining a schedule. So don't change until you might just lose that battle, right? And I certainly have seen it. I've seen it, for instance, with, you know, every once in a while when you have either a lead architect, like a principal architect coming to visit the site, you might say, oh no, that's not good. Because you know, they're likely to see something other going on. Or you have like a board member or something and you're like, oh no, you be careful. Be ready. And inevitably they come back and they say, well, we need to change that. And then the whole team mobilizes and says, oh my God, no, we can't make that change. Please don't make that change. And then, but before you know it, it's usually someone who's got the best interests of the institution in mind, and they're right. And no one wants to embrace the time and cost impact of it. And so you very, very much don't want to make that change, but ultimately, and maybe it just takes time to interrogate it and to really look carefully at the impact of it. And importantly, at the impact of not making the change. And then it comes around and say, yeah, we've got to make that change. It's just, we all see it. And I think that, again, you have to see it, you have to understand it. And I think that I understand why people say it, but it's like the idea that we're going to go in and we're never going to make change. That's the best thing for success when it comes to building any building, make no changes. And I mean, I'm not trying to make the projects, I'm not trying to bring change to them by any means. I just know that I don't think I've ever done one that hasn't changed. And I think there's a number of things that go into it. I think part of it is, it's this owner who is driven by excellence. That's a good thing, but they want to do something excellent. And when they see something that's good, and they see someone pose an option that makes it excellent, they're going to have a hard time saying no to excellent, because they're driven. I mean, they're museum professionals. They are driven by excellence. that's a good thing. There's a reason why a lot of those buildings that they create are excellent. And the architecture the same way. I mean, they've been hired by these owners because they're good. Like, they're really, really good at what they do. And if they come with a suggestion, what I usually say to an owner is, just hired one of the greatest architects practicing. Why would we not listen to them? Like, we should at least hear them out. And maybe that their drive to make this thing symmetrical doesn't really make, it's not that big of a deal, but maybe it really does. Maybe it's something that would really make things better. The use of the space better, the appearance of the space better, etc. Hear them out. You can always say no. But inevitably, a lot of these things happen. And it's because you have a group of people that are brought together by doing something extraordinary.
I had to laugh earlier at your description of the lead designer coming on the site and saying, don't let the lead designer on the site. Because
don't get me wrong, we always want them to come, but it's
I mean, the thing is, in my world, in exhibitions and experiences, I actually am the lead designer in projects that I do for clients when I'm not podcasting. And so this week, there were a couple of incidents that happened. And now that you mention that, I'm thinking, wait a minute, I think someone has told me to come to the site, not for my convenience. Yeah, it's not for my convenience. I've just realized.
Oh, look, Jonathan, there might be an earthquake. Don't come to the site. No.
That's right. Everything is fine, boss. Everything is good. The builders are here. They're really wrapping up. You probably won't have time to get to the site. Yeah, don't really. It's dark. There's a lot of bats. There's bats everywhere. Oh, I don't know. Okay, well, so change orders can sometimes be okay, or changes can be okay. Yes. Museum projects
but
are
planning
chaotic,
for
and that's
them,
a good thing.
Carry the right contingency.
Right.
That's part of it.
Exactly. Okay, quick recap. This was our list for today. We're talking museum projects are chaotic, and that's a good thing, with John Moss. We have 6 points. Number one, chaos theory studies things that are impossible to predict. Number two, museum projects are chaotic, and that's a good thing. Number three, a project is a cultural exercise with a diverse culture in the project. Number four, museum owners are not built to build buildings. Number five, design and building teams who excel at museum projects are rare. And number six, change during the process is inevitable, so embrace it. How'd we do? Do we hit all the points?
You did. Excellent.
I am still laughing about some of the things that you shared for that reason and all the other reasons. John Moss, it has been great to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's been really great to join you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk.
Absolutely. So, hey, if listeners would like to get in touch with you, what is the best method? Email, website, LinkedIn, let's spell them all out right here in case someone's walking the dog and they want to shoot you a note or link in with you or whatever.
The website and the email are a little bit unusual in so far as we're not a .com, we're a .works, W-O-R-K-S. So you can find us at mossworks, M-A-A-S-S .works. And you can reach me at jm@moss.works. Those are the two easiest way. Or you can call me 917-578-0190.
I love a phone number. Okay, so that's a .works domain name. MossWorks.
That's right.
MASS.works. Got it.
That's right.
Yeah. Beautiful. Okay. Looks like we covered it. Thank you, dear listener, for your time. In exchange, I hope this episode gave you some news you can use. If you would like to get in touch with me or you have an idea for the show, go to makingthemuseum.com and hit contact. You can also find me on LinkedIn under Jonathan Alger, A-L-G-E-R, or at the website of my firm, C&G Partners. And by the way, this podcast has an older sister. It's a one-minute newsletter of the same name, Making the Museum. One quick insight each time for museum leaders, exhibition teams, and visitor experience pros. Subscribe at makingthemuseum.com. Big subscribe button in the menu at the top. Meanwhile, I'm Jonathan Alger, and I hope you'll join me next time for Making the Museum. Bye for now.